conference record has joined the conference.
It's a wonderful thing. Realize.
All right, we're going to get started in another minute. Try and hit the rest of the agenda that we have before us on these slides, and we touched a little bit on some of it with the quality and health homes and ACOs, the indigent care, safety net, again, setting context largely. So we'll hit fast forward 50, John. We'll take it to
Pat Rowan.
Kathy.
Okay, so
Kathy, for those of you who don't know, works for Haney's, by the way. Pat was at the farm.
Hi, everybody. So the purpose of this section really is to implement the methods that are out there, the measures of quality, and relate to the quality of the community, start developing some recommendations for quality to incentivize the providers and drive some coordination across the various settings. So what we're probably doing is just what some of the metrics are that are out there right now, hopefully in enough detail so that it's helpful, not hopefully in so much detail that we put you right this way. But you do have an attachment, a whole series of charts that outline all of the metrics that are available right now in the public domain. And those are in pretty significant detail. What we also want to do is that we organize this section into three categories: the acute care, the home health, and also the managed care. And the reason for doing that is because the measurement field in terms of healthcare is still fairly new. And we've been developing these quality measures. The Joint Commission started, I think, in the 90s. At that time, it was, you know, sort of just reporting measures for the purposes of quality improvement. CMS began to adopt them, at least in the acute care sector, you know, in the early 2000s. And that's when it began, and then it began to develop data reporting, and now we're moving into data performance. But unfortunately, because the measures have been developed in a siloed fashion, what has happened is that we've got a lot of discordant measures. And what happens is that we don't have measures that really drive care around the patient. Rather, what they do is drive care that's provided in each individual setting. But there are some common themes that have come out on various measure sets. So a couple of things that this committee can think about is, what are some of the measures that cross all settings, and how do we use them to coordinate care among the settings? And that's what we really would like to do now. I also just wanted to make a comment about our earlier conversation. I think Ari had asked me, you know, if we started with some of the principles. And we talked about the principles for quality measurement, that first and foremost, it needed to be grounded as much as we can in the science and the literature, and if not, at least in the standard of practice. But done so in a way so that they're adaptable and flexible, because science takes time, and we need to be able to accommodate that and not penalize providers for providing the highest quality care because it's the most cutting edge. But the third piece of that that we really didn't talk about in the earlier discussion was that as this committee is considering different payment models to drive quality, to achieve, you know, certain budget savings, or to achieve high efficiency, I should say, then, you know, that principle is really saying that the quality, that payment decisions should be made in a quality method versus being made on some of the budget goals. And an example where this, you know, came under, I think, some, or a good example of this actually has to do with obstetrics. If you remember the last MRP, there was some conversation around decreasing utilization in areas where we believe there's higher utilization than what we would have expected. And so they looked at that. They looked at obstetrical care, looked at a high rate of cesarean sections in obstetrical care. And the initial thought was, well, we'll cut payment for cesarean sections. But after discussions with, you know, physicians and with hospital departments, they said, well, wait a minute, you know, there'd be some unintended consequences associated with just cutting cesarean section payments while there. And this is nothing to incentivize. Quality does nothing to promote adherence to a specific standard. And so they said, you know, we're going to take this back and we're going to talk to the experts and let the experts do
No, I think that that's very clear. Yeah, I learned a little bit of a lesson on the C-section thing, and I'll just leave it at that. I'm glad the race setters aren't doing it anymore.
So if you look at this particular slide, what you see is there's at least 16 that run across all of the various measures of stuff, whether you're talking about health or acute care providers or, you know, the outpatient care. You know, patients, and these things, by the way, aren't necessarily exclusive. There's a lot of overlap, for example, between preventative care measures and chronic measures. You know, in terms of the chronic measures, you're talking about diabetes, but a lot of the measures that have to do with testing and screening for diabetes could easily be put into a preventative category. Patient safety and some of the acute care measures clearly overlap. And there's been a lot of discussion, even more formally, at the federal level, you know, both CMS in terms of the Medicare program as well as in coordination with Medicaid, has been looking at ways for reducing hospital-acquired infections or of conditions in readmission. And then, of course, care coordination and transition. You know, patient satisfaction is another area. Now, that crosses, again, all of the settings. Probably the one area where we get a little more difficulty, I think, in terms of refining the measures so that they're more reflective of the patient population and the care that's needed. But also, it's an area where, you know, there continues to be evolving studies on that. Can we look at the next slide? This set here is a list of the measures that are currently in place for the hospital quality reporting program, both the outpatient program as well as the inpatient program, and also some of the Department of Health measures. And you'll see the measures that you're pretty familiar with. The CMS decided what measures it would include in its paper reporting and now in terms of the value-based purchasing program, and looked at those patient populations where it felt it had, you know, a high volume, there was high cost, and also where there was some science and evidence to base the measures. Over time, issues around heart attack and heart failure and pneumonia, you know, have evolved. The measures have become more refined. We've learned a lot in that process. And you're seeing more and more measures come on the table. We started out, you know, maybe with about a dozen. I think there's 55 right now. These are all payer measures. Even though they're recorded through the Medicare program, they're all payer measures. And the goal, of course, is to move away from right now what is really a medical record review, almost like a scan identification of some of these measures and reporting, which is very expensive in terms of collecting measures and building the infrastructure. Sounds like it should be easy, but once you try and get into it, you realize collecting data and reporting measures is a very expensive enterprise. We need to do it, but we need to do it efficiently. So those are measures. One of the things I would mention that's not on here is a new initiative by CMS. It's called the Partnership for Patients. The Partnership for Patients initiative is a broad umbrella that CMS is using. It is looking at ways to reduce hospital-acquired conditions by 40% and to reduce preventable readmissions by 20%. There are a number of different initiatives under that broad umbrella that affect nursing homes, that affect hospitals, that do with policy goals, as well as some incentive programs, and also looking at care transition. And what you'll see in those initiatives is a real focus on infections, which I know is a category that's very important in the Medicaid program as well, with an expanded list of infections where the goal is really to provide best practice models, work closely with healthcare providers, helping them to implement and execute on those measures, and then to report that information. So you'll see the expanded set of measures, and we've seen great progress in terms of the success that has been achieved as well, you know, since these measures had originally been reported. I think earlier we mentioned about some of the CMS measures, or maybe it was Bill, but essentially in terms of some of the quality measures around heart attack, heart failure, and pneumonia, the average score for hospitals is in the 90s. We've made tremendous progress in terms of how well hospitals are adhering to some practices there. Still more progress to be made, but tremendous progress. And as those numbers, as more and more hospitals are in that 90 to 100 range, their distribution gets tighter and tighter. So it's very hard to distinguish a high quality performer from, you know, someone else, when it might only be 2 percentage points, you know, between 98% and 100%, and that the hospital is 98% might be penalized as a result of that. So that gets to some of these issues around the importance of being able to update measures and the importance of being able to provide some measures are. And, you know, if you look at what the Department of Health is doing and the measures that are collected there, you'll see there's a whole host of other measures through the registry information. And I know the department is working on an all-payer database that will begin to align those particular measure sets and integrate them so that they will be much more easy, I think, to extract and analyze for the purposes of other quality improvement and analysis. And then the next one. In these measures here, you know, the physicians have been in the voluntary quality reporting program. Rick, I'm not sure if you'd like to add to this, but essentially the doctors have the option of reporting certain quality measures, and that's done electronically through CMS. It's a paper reporting program. That is developing long-term into a value-based purchasing program, and then it'll no longer be voluntary, it will become mandatory. And the reason why there's so many measures is because it's frankly something so many different conditions. So it's really important that they be able to target the measures to the population that's most important to them. And I think when we talk about the HEDIS measures, and Pam's going to talk a little bit more about what they're collecting in terms of Medicaid to address some of those issues. Rick, I'm going to be running to
you.
Slide from the original MRC presentation on January 15th, word for word, and basically to make sure everyone knows where I want to start this presentation from. We've been collecting information on quality, called the Quality Assurance Reporting Requirements, which is based on HEDIS, for over 15 years. And HEDIS really started on the commercial world, for those who know the genesis of it. Really is a way for employers to figure out, I'm paying a capitation, what am I getting for it? So, really, the managed care movement and the measurement movement had a tie early on in managed care that we began. In fact, we were doing Medicaid HEDIS before Medicaid HEDIS was really a term. So we've been doing this a very long time. Myself, Buster Gessens on CPM, and my colleague, MC Arts on CPM, the Committee for Performance Measurement, which is a national body that working for you're volunteering for NCQA to make sure measures are measurable, that they're up to date, that they have the most evidence we can, that they're fair, they're equitable, and it's a significant process at NCQA through the HEDIS process for new measure development in terms of testing. So we at the beginning we did a lot of New York State specific measures. We tend not to because of the rigor that NCQA puts in the measures. The other thing I think is real important about what we collect in CLAR and HEDIS is that we have regulatory authority to collect this information across all the payers I have up there, Medicaid, Child Health Plus, commercial managed care, commercial PPO business, which began about 2 years ago. Medicaid also includes Family Health Plus. We also collect information on the three HIV SNPs, as well as the currently one Family Health Plus buy-in program. So, it's a fairly comprehensive measurement set across many different insured types.
But not EPOs. Not EPOs.
So, a significant number of measures, which I'll get into in a second. And also, I think it's relevant to this group. It's been right around 10 years now, we've had a paper performance program called the Quality Incentive. Initially, that began as a 1% add-on for premium. It's now a 3% add-on. That's an algorithm that looks at quality, patient satisfaction, some compliance measures in there, as well as preventable hospitalization. So the next slide. So HEDIS and CLAR really began with many, with many measures of really preventive care. Did you get a cervical cancer screen? Over time, that has evolved to significant measures, measure sets on chronic care, to where you see the numbers of measures. That's the number in parentheses of the number of measures for each of these domains. So we measure child and adolescent health. The obvious ones are immunization and well visits, but there are other measures such as ADHD care, which is a fairly new measure. Under chronic care, there's many different categories, certainly diabetes, asthma, COPD under respiratory, cardiovascular conditions, HIV care. Many of the HIV cares are New York State specific, across the mainstream plans. And managing medication. Medication management is a huge issue in healthcare, which we're all aware of. How well are people adhering to the medication for significant chronic conditions? Women's health, behavioral health, patient satisfaction. Kathy has mentioned patient satisfaction, one of the six circles in her presentation. I think if you look at that list, it covers all of them for the most part, except for county patient safety. Provider network is a big issue in terms of access. It may not be quality per se, but access to provider network is really the precursor to quality. If you can't get a provider, if you're not happy with the provider, the chance you get high quality care is pretty low. And lastly, we do have two PQIs, preventive quality indicators, which are AHRQs, version of ambulatory sensitive conditions. These are measures of hospitalizations that we believe potentially could be avoided.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
All these are appropriately focused on providers and systems or institutions. I would suggest that we include the pharmaceutical companies and the choice of the Medicaid system for what is in the formularies. So as an example, there are a bevy of things that Medicaid continues to pay for, which the pharmaceutical companies make huge amounts of money, like Zyprexa. It just makes people fat and have diabetes and doesn't do anything more than 10 other psychotropics that are generics. So there's a whole host of drugs that have kind of gotten through. So it should be evidence-based. We should be targeting the pharmaceutical companies and the vendors the same way we're tasking ourselves to perform better.
So if there are you...
Abilify is a commonly used drug approved by Medicaid. And there are 10 other generics that we could be using that don't cause any of the side effects, but it has been tailored that way somehow, who knows how, so the pharmaceutical companies can make a huge amount of money. So I just think that should be part of our quality assessment and monitoring. What are the drugs we're using in the Medicaid system?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and Greg's here as well, and I can kind of add Medicare will have the benefit of pharmacy. We'll move into Medicare in 2 weeks. 11 days, 10 days. And so this will be now a plan issue in terms of coverage, which we still certainly need to look at. On the fee for service side, Greg, I'm not sure if you're quite the answer to this kind of spot in terms of some of the preferred drugs.
Well, I
think
drug thing, but we had, for years been pursuing the ability to prior authorize certain classes of drugs, including atypical. And we were, finally successful last year in doing so. So I think we're probably on the fringe of doing a little better management in the plan PBM than also the fee for service at the same time.
I have a comment that far, and how it relates to future activities. And I think that although this book was really well designed, we put into practice both the provider and the board member. It has lots of problems. For example, the measures are not always known beforehand, so some measures rotate off. And the time frame in which they're looked at, you don't really know what those measures are so that you can affect them. And it's all retrospective, so it's all a retrospective look at. Versus these are the indicators we're going to be looking at moving forward. And then people can really align themselves with those and use them as their own performance measures within their organization.
So let me make two comments on that. One, first, the measures, if you're talking about the incentive, that's a specific question over here, but the measures are, depending on the type of measure we talked about, Kathy alluded to this, a medical record review measure compared to administrative measure. Typically, the administrative measures are calculated every year. Because the cost is low. The medical record review measures are rotated typically every other year. And those are dictated. We do follow the national guidelines on that. So, for example, for diabetes care, not only do we want to know what hemoglobin A1C test, we want to know what the level is to see if it's in control or not, which I think is a very good measure for diabetes care. That measure, because we have to do a chart review today, we don't have electronic medical record across the state, is a costly measure. So, we rotate that every other year. So in terms of the analysis of the measures, we do follow the national standard. So there is some things that I think I'll disagree with you. You should know what measures are coming. You don't be made, and you probably could guess what a rotated, but it's not perfect. Jumping over to the incentives, actually, we actually made a conscious decision not to tell you what the measures are. It was on purpose, because we thought there was a little studying for the test. So this is after years of doing it. You can critique that. You can say that that's not a good idea. But what happened would be that there'd be that list of measures, and there would be the focus on 10 measures. The focus should be on the measures. Okay. Now, we can say some of those measures aren't as important as others. We can have that discussion, and that's already a long list of measures. So the thought was it'd be more comprehensive, not to get a list. That was by design. So if we can debate that. I mean, that's what this is
for. I just think that there's a lot of lessons.
Thank you. So just a very quick background there, sort of for the national scene, because a lot of the concerns are concerns at the national level. So the proliferation of measures is certainly a discussion at NCQA and NQF. NQF has almost 700 measures in its portfolio, and more coming down the pipe. And we have had lots of discussions about moving from process measures to outcome measures, to composite measures, and to having a smaller portfolio of more important measures. So that is a debate that's going on nationally that I think we need to keep in mind in our discussions here. And there is a tension, certainly at the national level, between measures for QI and measures for public reporting, and really for measures that have money attached to them. The standards, the criteria, the pushback on whether a measure is good enough or not goes up considerably depending on what is attached to that measure. So we just need to be aware of that, that measures that are used for incentivizing or rewarding or with dollars attached are going to have be held to a far higher standard of evidence and the integrity of the measure than perhaps some other measure for QI for internal QI.
I would be interested in a perspective. My impression is that many, many of these measures are measures of process. And we do that in lieu of a system or the data that would measure outcomes. But that has to be the gold standard that we're moving toward. And I realize that we're sort of in prehistory still. But I'm interested in the state's view of the tools that would be necessary to do that and the progression of development that would lead to that and where we are now.
I think the conversation about process and outcomes really the genesis of the beginning of this whole idea. And I'll start by saying I totally agree with the need to get to more outcomes, but we really stink at process. Okay? And process leads to outcomes. The RAND study, the Beth McClin study, we as adults are getting 53-54% of the stuff we're supposed to get that are no brainers. I'm 52 years old, I should get this, and this. That's real. So, totally agree, but we're not good at the process. Outcome measures are going to cost more money. That's a different problem. So, a good one is, how are we doing? I think we've all been wanting to see that. Anyone see how are we doing it? It's a charity right now. Charities cost money. So, if there's a balance, what we try to draw a balance, I know it's a QA, but okay, they try to draw a balance not to have too many of these medical records because they cost a tremendous amount of money too. Are they valuable? They're unbelievably valuable. The other thing with that measure, for example, though, it gets more complicated on accountability. So I'm going to continue to think on this. Okay, so I'm diabetic and I eat whatever I want to eat and I weigh whatever I want to weigh and I don't move. Am I doing it health plan for that? Am I doing it as a provider for that? Because my outcome is bad. Now that's a debate. It's a hard debate, because some of these things become more—they're not as clear as everybody wants. So the perfect outcome on the hospital side, which is historical, is mortality. Okay, perfect in terms of measurement, not perfect in anything else. Certainly, Ed Hannon's work is great work on the cardiac, but the outcome is mortality for many of those measures. There's a lot of, in mountain who managed care plans, I'll say this facetiously, we're hoping we're not killing a lot of people here. So it's not a good outcome. What are the other outcomes? Complications, maybe a good outcome in the health society. But again, there's some measurement to that. So I'm with you. I think we're all with you, but it's hard to get to it.
I know there's many difficulties.
And I think it should be a goal. I totally agree.
I was going to say, is it a goal with a plan? Is it a strategy? Will we know when we are on the track or not on the track to do that? And I assume that has to do with data and therefore information system, which is a priority.
Wanted to chime in here, if I could.
Well, the example you use about the diabetic patient, quite frankly, finally, you said the magic word, and that is the patient and the responsibility of the patient for compliance here. Because, and as we move down this track, that absolutely has to be a component of the larger picture here, whether it's patient education, it's patient incentives, because, again, for the physicians, you know, you can prescribe, and you can do, and you can counsel, and you can educate, but for whatever reason, if the patient is not compliant, it's not going to work.
Pharmacy adherence alone. Think about how complicated.
If I could, this is a broad-based debate with uncertain borders in all directions. So, and I think Pat's point is right. We have a very good product. So I would just try to continue the discussion by asking, what is it we think as this group we need, or you wish to tell us that you want to do? Is there more you want to do? Do you want us to see this as baseline enough? I mean, in terms of our deliberations, I think I would try to get the question a little more localized.
I'm trying to answer Rhonda's question. I think the state could be very helpful in, as an example, your example of not having the farm, whether or not the prescriptions, that information exists. It needs to be. They need to. To task, whether it's the PBMs, the pharmacies, the distributors, for that information. The systems and the providers need to know if the prescription was filled outside their system. So there's obviously the end game in my mind would be transparency with robust information systems, but that's not going to happen tomorrow. So along the way, we need to integrate the information that's readily available, but hard to get it. Then there's a whole bucket of questions about Rios and realizing more a higher level of performance out of them, which we could have, and I'm trying to adhere to the words. But I mean, there's stuff out there that we can use to improve the care that's unavailable to us and perhaps not even looked at by you.
I guess I just want to sort of go back to the question. I'm really cognizant that there are large national forums grappling with these issues in the general level. So I think the question for us is, what's the specific question on the table? I mean, we could spend years on this. Is the specific question on the table, are the current measures adequate for reform activity that we want to undertake? Is that the question? Are these, the measures we have now, do they support what we want to do with ACOs or bundling or gain sharing? Do we have what we need? And I think the question is then, if we don't think we have what we need, then I think we have to sort of frame the question and think about how we get there. But I guess I want to ask is that the right question?
And I just think that following up on what you're saying, you mentioned that part of the problem is that we spent a lot of time on the quality indicators that are more process-oriented and not outcome-oriented because we really suck at processing, which I think a lot of us would tend to agree. But I think the other part of it is then what is the investment that we need to make in the infrastructure to be able to improve the processes and create efficiencies that would allow us to move to the outcome side.
Are you envisioning broadening this database? I mean, clearly you're replete with opportunity and things to include. That's not the problem. Are you looking for selective additions? Like the next slide is you have measurements and development. That's part of what you're envisioning.
Let me just go quickly through that. Efficiency measures, many of us are familiar with what we're doing. We are essentially central readmission. The readmission as a whole, we think, can be reduced that they're connected to the initial readmission. Essentially, preventable conditions. I'm not sure if this is the complication that we're actually working on. That's an MRT proposal that we're working with both hospital associations on that as well. I mentioned the PQIs, preventable hospitalization. So, there's a lot of talk on the national level about these efficiency measures. These are, of course, low-hanging fruit of potential savings, but we still have a lot of work to do both on the measurement side and then how do we affect change. There's a report from through the Health Foundation on readmissions last week, I think it was late last week, on how we do this now with potential suggestion that may not be the best way to do it. So, you know, right now we actually take a rate, if you have a poor rate of CPR, we reduce your rate, your overall hospital rate. They're suggesting maybe a better way to do it, maybe through simulation, maybe some analytics on it, and a better way maybe doing bundled payments, meaning we don't pay for readmissions, period, that you pay more for every indexed admission, but you're on the hook for 30 days after for all those subsequent admissions. Now, there's certainly issues with that they didn't talk about in that paper, including you go from hospital A to hospital B, and hospital B actually fixed the problem from hospital A. But I think those are things for dialing you should take a look at. And then on the measurement development side, what I don't think we collect very well in Medicaid, because this has really been managed care, really mental health and substance abuse measures, mm-hmm. and on the national stage, there are not a lot of measures there. And the ones that are there have not been tested very often. So we have a little work group. We've worked about 3 months to formate a very collaborative work group. I think we're going to have 2 or 3 measures we're going to roll out this year across all sectors of Medicaid, be it a plan, be it a VHO, be it fee-for-service, to say, and these measures are fairly simple. For people that are hospitalized, did they have a visit within 7 days or 30 days? How do they compare with plans? How do they compare with the VHO? How do they compare with fee-for-service? That's one area where we're working on, and the other one is long-term care. There's not a lot of measures on long-term care. We have a measure set in long-term care, managed long-term care, lines up pretty well with OASIS is done for the home care care project at the federal level. And on that, also, I'm trying to go quick because we have a lot, there's a uniform assessment system on long-term care, which literally all community-based long-term care will have the same assessment tool, which we can measure uniformly across all sectors of long-term care, all community-based long-term care. So I think that's a lot. The other thing I would say is we can be consistent on what we're doing already. Try to do with health pumps to not create new measures, but to kind of build up what we already have.
Do we see reports in Quora?
The preventable hospitalizations now are currently reported in Quora. We haven't reported them yet.
And we're within, is that where
they live? We could do it by hospital, we could do it by plan or both. The payment adjustment for CPR is both hospital and managed care.
And
the
new tool for the long term.
The uniform assessment tool that work has begun, and for managed different stage on different sectors will begin using that tool. Currently, we have 8 to 10 different tools out there. We'll have one tool. I believe managed long-term care will happen sometime late as well, but fairly quickly. They're not the first wave. Everything on the efficiency slides are risk adjusted. They're not risk adjusted enough for you right now. About regional for that.
They're risk adjusted for comorbidities. They're risk adjusted for comorbidities. They're not risk adjusted for social economic status. It's different.
Well,
the
one thing here is that everybody is Medicaid.
I'm sorry, it's an answer. That's fair.
Certainly, we can have conversations about risk-adjusted efficiency. I think the other, again, way too long of a conversation, but when you go to process measures, which I would argue these aren't, but I would argue you don't, and many would argue, you don't risk-adjust process measures. We don't want to risk-adjust regions for utilization rates, but we do. So when you go toward outcomes, as long as we're in agreement on that.
Right.
which seems to me like an important system measure and an efficiency measure. Is that on the screen at all, or is there a reason that you think differently about that than others?
Well, mainly just because it isn't in our radar screen. We haven't talked about it. In fact, it's part of the health home measurement set. So you'll see that when Greg starts going through. But totally agree, and did many of the same. I've seen it used the same conditions for preventable hospitalizations, using the same set for preventable ER.
And
so
those are
things
like asthma and diabetes. And
CHS.
That should be treated as primary care. A question about the QARA measures. Is it safe to presume that these are all sort of claims-based size measures? Or in general?
The majority of them are,
okay.
Like, but there are some medical record review measures.
So hybrid sort of chart review
right.
Measures, okay. And maybe, you know, patient satisfaction may be being different.
Right.
Is there a plan, because depending on some of the payment reform things we look at, is there a plan to start to sort of transition towards or incorporate chart or clinically based measures that theoretically start to come out of the EHR? We have some of this for meaningful use in the ambulatory and inpatient state, and to start to incorporate what can come out of the clinical space of the chart. Is there?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'd help home to get to an electronic medical record. The reality is, I totally agree, we're just not there. And at the end of the day, we have to have mechanisms to be able to report both ways unless we need
absolutely. Oh, yeah, we're going to be on dual tracks for an insanely long amount of time, but I just think that other train is starting to sort of inch up the track a little bit.
So just to speak to that, it might be helpful for the group to have an understanding of what various federal programs are requiring in terms of electronic capacity, quality measures, pharmacy, prescribing, et cetera, so that we know what, as background, what the possible is.
Absolutely. So I just got my first report for 500 physicians and, you know, ambulatory physicians across the Hudson Valley and our EHR install base, and their first 30 days of performance on their set of meaningful quality measures. Really awful and messy and just how you would expect it, but it's, you know, for certain groups, there is the ability to calculate. So it starts.
Not that we need any more work, but and this is speculative to a degree anyway, but on this issue about risk adjusting, I was thinking if you took the Capital District and Queens, New York, maybe if you're just looking at the Medicaid population as a general aggregate number, you wouldn't see much difference. But I wonder if you instead went into zip codes or sub-zero zip codes, and you said, no, it's Jamaica, Queens, you know, and it's the poorest section of Albany and the poorest section of Schenectady. It might turn out that that's where it might jump out that there's more need for risk adjustment where there's intense concentrations of poverty as opposed to just Medicaid as a poverty indicator. This is work Dr. Cooper had done for us on readmissions while we were fighting this at a national level. And that popped out, and I wonder if it would pop out on the plan slide as well. It might be something to look at. Preventable readmission rates that were deemed too high that the plans are not supposed to
don't think it's going to be hard to avoid that at the end of this discussion somewhere down the road.
But the amount is so much smaller than the rest of the, right? I mean, the amount was $7 billion on managed care, right? And what we're talking about is $60
billion. Not sure.
I don't disagree with you, but.
$60 billion.
I mean, I'm just saying that we're spending. I'll defer to Donna, but I mean, it seems to me the amount that's spent that's going through, and it's not that I don't disagree with you at the end of the day, Pat. But I guess I'm just saying is that the amount of money going into managed care is $7 billion, and the amount of money that we're talking about on all these other portions of this PowerPoint, a lot more. Whatever that number.
I mean, there are a number of large actuarial firms in the nation that set Medicaid managed care rates. They certify them to the federal government. And the conversation goes something like, what should we expect that the managed care plans should be able to one, how should they change and reducing unnecessary bureaucracy but it falls into that efficiency factor. And so I think it goes to the question of accountability on any of these. That raises some accountability issues around outcome measures, and I think the question on ER is should the plan, should a health plan be held accountable for inappropriate use of the ER? Does it mean that there's not sufficient provider networks, that the primary care provider wasn't available when they should have been? And that's really how the measure, that's how they measure the efficiency in managed care. It's a more global comment, though. I kind of like to say that, you know, I think from this discussion, rightfully, there's a lot of focus on what the measures are, that what our Medicaid managed care experience tells us is that the decisions that are made by the payers in implementing those measures are having much impact. So the policies around not only what measures, but do you know what measures they are in advance? Do you risk adjust, not risk adjust, based on what our important discussions are?
The initiative to measure the outcomes and migrate from process to outcomes is the right way to go, and we need to do that. And I also agree that we're on two tracks. There's paper records and there's digitized records. I have a feeling that in the Medicaid world, digitized record is actually more advanced than we might be recognizing in this discussion for a variety of reasons. So I would suggest that we might want to speak to preparing for when you would just get the downloads, which if tomorrow everybody was digitized, there's still a long way to go to interface standardization of a particular outcome. I mean, I can get into a long discussion about hemoglobin A1C and what context it comes in, and an important one, distinction. And then how you receive it, and prepare with a data warehouse. Because those if all the tracks were laid, we still couldn't do this probably for 5 years well. So we should be incentivizing people to be able to report the data, and you should be preparing to receive it so that we have universal information.
And I would point out, based on what Steve said, you know, just doing the math on the patient-centered medical home recognition at level 3, that's roughly 2,200 providers in New York State at level 3 ambulatory providers. You have to have an electronic health record to be at level 3 by definition. That's a substantive portion of the physician population, and we know it's probably larger than that even. We know that our adoption rate in the Hudson Valley has clearly tipped over 50 and is moving towards 60%. So this train in the ambulatory space, I think, is moving, and I think there's real opportunity, and I think there's real opportunity to start to work on outcome out of the clinical record. And again, I think it's just a piece of what's added in here. You know, just a piece that's integrated. And the claims-based stuff doesn't go away. It's still there. It's still the baseline. It's still a fundamental engine. But there's a real opportunity, I think, to look at real important issues.
Okay.
care
as a first step on dealing with that. Now come to the bottom two quadrants. We've hierarchically stripped out, so now by the time I've got to the bottom, you don't have developmental disabilities. You haven't consumed 120 days or more of long-term care. Now the next quadrant we strip folks out on, did you have a mental health or substance abuse diagnosis? So we have mental health and substance abuse folks up in the first two quadrants because those were hierarchically selected that way. But in the main, we're now looking at our folks without developmental disabilities, not consuming long-term care. They're consuming $6.3 billion if they had a mental health or substance abuse diagnosis on the claim. About 400,000 people, relatively large PMPM, decent dual penetration, but most of our duals, again, are on the upper part of the chart. Very large managed care penetration is growing, but the services on the behavioral health side, in the main, not in the plan benefit package. So we got a bifurcated benefit, and we got a lot of spend, and we see these folks need a tailored solution, which I think really was the main focus of the federal health funds that quadrant, actually, in terms of thinking. Then we've got the everybody else bucket, which is now I've got two or more chronic medical conditions. I may only have HIV here, and about 300,000 folks. Fifth of them dual, 70% of them in managed care, and some of these people may respond positively to a traditional care management approach or a traditional chronic disease management program, but many of them won't because they have more than one chronic medical illness. So, just a couple of things about what's not in here. We got about 3.6 million healthy people or people that have an acute illness. I think we've designed most of our healthcare system around that population, which most of us have struggled, particularly with the bottom two pieces of this equation, particularly organized primary care and specialty care together. When we look at this through a dollar lens, about 18% of our member months are driving about half of our spend, and that's even is somewhat mitigated by the fact that that includes plan premium in it. So when you strip out plan premium and you look just at fee-for-service, we've got about 147,000 people that are driving $7 billion in expenses in the program. And those are people that are pairs, triples, or HIV. 150,000 people, $7 billion. So I think the going-in assumption here and getting to this issue of health home as program versus health home as centerpiece of a larger redesign, I think this is probably where the money is if we can create a more efficient healthcare delivery system and we can create some downstream risk and reward at the plan level, at the provider level, on these groups of patients and actually change their care profile. These are the dollars we may be able to return to reinvest to actually keep the healthcare system happening post all of the semi-depressing federal stuff we looked at the beginning of this. Just a couple more things. When we actually drill into this population, and the only reason I want to stay on data for a second is I think it's the fuel for payment reform, that this is the group, that we could try to tailor payment reform to the whole population, and really I think our ROI is here. And if you get inside that $25.9 billion and you look a little bit more carefully at it, John Billings worked with us on our chronic illness model to look at risk of future inpatient utilization, had a predictive model that looked back at 3 years of utilization to predict for next year's future inpatient utilization, create a risk score for each individual that was in CIDP. PATH folks have now replicated that method for our entire health home population. But on the CIDP population, for the people that were greater than 50% of risk in that risk model, about three-quarters of them had substance abuse diagnosis. About two-thirds of them had a mental health diagnosis. 70% of the alcohol and substance abuse folks also had a mental illness. So we're looking at folks that are behaviorally challenged, certainly. And then when we look at that group, the group that had mental health and or substance abuse issues, about a half of them were hypertensive. About a quarter of them were diabetic. A third of them were asthmatic, and a fifth of them had COPD. So I think many of your institutions are actually are getting this, that if we're going to really address the public health insurance issue and try to bring dollars back into the system that exists now, whether it's locking in levels that feds are paying us now or taking existing state resources and locking them down in the downstream providers or plans, we have to probably, I would submit, figure out a way to deliver integrated care and to bake care management into that integrated care. We can't treat hypertension in the Medicaid population without knowing how to manage mental health and substance abuse. We can't manage mental health and substance abuse without leveraging proper specialty care for this population. And this is not required for everybody, but we have to have substructures, I would submit, for the pieces of this group that are most likely to end up in our inpatient programs next year. And so I think I'm going to take questions in a second. So I think what health homes give me is some federal dollars. They're going to give us 90% matching money to experiment with what care coordination models will maybe work to start to reduce some of this cyclical spend. And with that, I'll just pause a second. I guess I'll give you hands to go up.
Well, you know, and that's why I think the community and social components of the health home is critically important. Because, again, if we're expecting this challenged population to come to provide us care, we're kidding ourselves. We've got to go out and reach those populations. And again, we shouldn't recreate new infrastructure, but rather use, if you will, medical model and model or social model infrastructures that already exist. But again, the care is, you know, we've got to bring the care to the people. I think that might be pie in the sky, but theoretically, we've got to bring the care to the people, and people will never get to the care.
Yeah, the reminds me of the old San Kennedy routine, which I won't repeat. But that's absolutely correct. And what we've learned from our demos is we have to do both outreach and inreach. And a lot of some of these patients are engaged in ambulatory. We've done a loyalty analysis. Some of them are showing up for medical but not behavioral health. Some of them are in the behavioral health system but not effectively managed on the medical side. So I think part of it is drawing that together, and then the other is for people that are chronically outside of care, that have no primary care, either ambulatory substance abuse, mental health, or physical health care, we have to bring them in. So, go ahead.
I'm so curious as to, have you been able to drill down to look at in each of the buckets how much med management is a driver toward other costs? And I'm thinking, you know, the developmentally disabled, you know, I'm on that People First Steering Committee, and so many of their patients, the effective med management keeps them stable, keeps them out of higher levels of care. And have you been able, do you have that data? Is that hard to get at?
I would say, you know, with Pat's help that we're getting there. So we have this lens now. I think the lens is very helpful to get into subpopulation analysis and exactly who and where some of those issues are. We have the Psyches tool that I think OMH has been promoting that we're looking to pull in that looks at med compliance issues, looks at polypharmacy issues, feeds information back into prescribers' hands about compliance patterns that are a problem. We've been doing some of that work in our retro and our prospective drug utilization review. And I think now what we get with health home is a purchased network to actually potentially make that information actionable, to hold a network of providers accountable for change management with that information. So what we've done here in Health Homes, and you know many of you know this, and I'll be repeating it, is we've encouraged the formation of broad med networks, including hospital partners, community-based partners broadly represented from housing, mental health, substance abuse, social service agencies, health plans, and it asked folks to come in with a letter of intent to do this. We got 165 letters of intent to build health homes just for the bottom two quadrants here. Our goal right now, between now and our go-live date, November 1, is to try to collapse that revenue discussion about focusing it regionally, but also to collapse those networks a little bit to create a smaller footprint with maybe larger firepower. So we're assigning larger bullets to patients, more active and robust networks. At that point, both the state and the health plan have an entity with which to say, you're our boots on the street relative to this population. We'll work with you about how fast and how many you can take, but the same quality metrics that affects it, those will go to the next slide. The same basic array of quality metrics that Pat talked about before, we've selected a subset. These have been submitted to CMS throughout on our website with our spot submission. This is the focus. But if I were to take all of those off and say, you know, what is the primary goal here? It's to keep people out of the hospital. You know, that's it. And the whole, well, this whole thing is all, everything else builds back to that. Primary care connectivity, speed to specialty follow-up, speed to mental health appointment, substance appointment, care management, health promotion. It's all about how can we keep this population out of the hospital because that's what's the cost structure. And in the end, what we end up with here, both for the fee-for-service and more importantly on the managed care side, is our resource to potentially try to do that change. I mean, I think Pat articulated earlier that on our managed care structure, we've been doing a decent job of converting service dollars back to capitation payment, but we've really never enhanced that fully on care management for dealing with these kinds of populations, and we haven't constructed the benefit package in a way to create those kinds of incentives. So.
Well, I think the chart speaks for itself. I think also appropriately so, you've taken advantage of federal money to build an infrastructure. But I go back to the point I made earlier today, which is that this infrastructure long-term will be tied to the success of a payment reform committee, which we sit on, not on the establishment of these health homes. So just take the bottom left quadrant. It's very important to understand exactly where we're going to go with DHOs. The payment stream is fragmented, we remain with a great resource that I don't think can bridge that fragmentation. And you could apply that to substance abuse and any of the other issues here. These are huge targets, but unless you tether the payment to the providers in the system, you're not going to get the change that you're seeking long term. And one last point, which is the first two bits, I think Phyllis made it earlier. In building any of these care management systems, you're not going to get the big savings in the first 2 years. That's the length of time of this. In the year 3, 4, 5 is when you really start to hit your stride. And if there's not the glide path into something that's going to carry it forward, we'll be back here.
Elizabeth and Phil.
I was just wondering, and forgive me if you mentioned this, just what's the plan for evaluating whether health homes work or not, and when will we start having data that we can react to, whether it's on the quality measures, on the savings measures, on whatever, you know, I mean, when will we even know? It sort of seems like a big experiment that we don't, I mean, can you just sort of talk a little bit about how, when we'll know if it works or not?
Sure, so, you know,
how we measure what works? Yeah.
Pat mentioned earlier, just briefly as a precursor to this, that what we've tried to do in our CMS promise here is to keep it simple. We've anchored most of our stuff to things that we're currently collecting that are HEDIS measures and CORE.
Right.
So those are process measures that we ongoingly collect that will be available to us immediately upon assignment to know how somebody's doing. It'll be able to, you know, test.
So the first one wouldn't be, but that wouldn't be for another year. So it'd be like the earliest would be December 2012 from one of those, right?
Well, theoretically, I would just say this, that we will have data on the health home population as soon as claims and encounters come in. How we package that, how quickly we push it out, becomes an infrastructure question. So what we're really looking to build beneath this, and thought we might get into this a little bit more in the second meeting, is some portaling capability where we can more real-time-ish feed information back to the health home network and the treating providers about how patients in health homes are doing. So how many ED visits did John, who just got assigned to a health home, have pre- and post-health home assignment, which is could theoretically be only constrained by claims lag. We could rapid cycle push that information back to providers. On the pharmacy side, theoretically, because claims are paid at point of sale, we could push information even more quickly on that, on med compliance and things that were talked about earlier. And I think key to this, again, is going to be rapid cycle data back to the health home and the ability of health home network partners to share information with each other, because we get data much more slowly than the actual network has access to that data. So those that are plugged in either through a Rio or other substructures within the health home network that can share that data among partners are actually better positioned to do change management than waiting for Pat and me and a few other nerds to send data back down through a portal. So it's our hope that as quickly as possible, each network will begin sharing information. We've designed a uniform consent that will deal with mental health, substance abuse, HIV, and medical all in one form. And we're trying to pull the Rio form into that, so we actually have one form. That's a little challenging, but we're trying right now. But it would be our goal to share the data that comes in quickly back quickly. Some other things will take some more time.
So I think I asked my question badly. I'm sorry. I was trying to say when will like state policymakers have evaluation points to sort of know how this is all going? Are we sort of thinking that 6 months down the pike or years down the pike? Or?
From the data perspective, breaking the populations up by diagnosis finer than these kind of
Right.
You know, the idea that they want you to be comprehensive makes a lot of sense and goes to, I forget who mentioned, I think you did, around the mental health and you did it around the mental health and the acute care with medical care. But what I don't understand is, why do they care what populations go in as long as each individual who's managed only gets 2 years of funding? Any person that comes in, why should they care about that? That's an arbitrary thing to these populations. And if you do it by region, which helps something, what it does is says you got 2 years in the Bronx, then you get 2 years in Brooklyn, you get 2 years, 2 years.
That's correct.
And the whole idea is if over time I take 100 the first month and I build up and then maybe I'm 1,000 the second day, maybe it's 3,000 to 30,000 or something, I have a stream that's going to last me and help us through that transition.
Yeah. So, you know, again, if this group wants to recommend, you know, we've had a hard time dealing with the issue of breaking the group up beneath the four buckets in meaningful ways other than we're trying to slow down the kids. So we built a kids model. We tried to, you know, I don't know for the group with all the technical details, but we've worked out some ways to separate children. If there are other populations that we want to hold out to later, we have to do that by diagnosis, because we have to target by diagnosis. And then, again, it just gets complicated because of all the crossover issues. But if you want to make that recommendation,
I think there's two issues conceptually. There's the pace, Phyllis was speaking to, which is important, which was linked to sustainability. And then where is the money underneath going to? But the real money is not in health funds. That's a one-time, that's 2 years, federal money you're taking advantage of. But it is paving the way for something, either a cliff or a glide or something big. In the mental health fund, it's clear of the money. It's at this moment from a different arm of the state going to be outsourced to BHOs. Am I right?
Well, the BHO piece of this has to be thought through.
Well, I think we should think it through here because I think to fragment mental health, the point you're making here is that we have grossly underestimated the amount of mental health challenges we have in the state because you're only targeting it based on what medicines they're on or some diagnosis. We've underdiagnosed it. It's across the board in all these complicated cases. And once the outside companies come in, it's a way of siphoning money out of the state and not reinvesting in the system.
So that's a question.
And it's fragmented.
I guess.
It's managed care all over again.
Yeah, so that's a question of who's held accountable for what and when. And I think that's a good question. And how do we bring together, because remember, in year one, the BHO job is to do concurrent inpatient review for psych.
It's called denying care. It's what we did in the early 90s. What we're trying to grapple with here is how we change the system.
I agree.
And I think the agenda here is progressive and in the right direction. I think if under the covers, if the money's going somewhere else, we're undermining ourselves.
And so on the BHO front, I think what we reserve for future years was the conversation about services dollars and where do those get kept.
Yeah.
And so I think what health homes and the slowness of the BHO integration allows us to do is to study that for a little bit together. So, and the options are, is it an existing health plan that's accountable, and what is the health plan accountable for? What do we build as an ACO option, and what are they held accountable for, and where can those actually operate? Where do we have arms and legs at work? And then what is the behavioral health organization's potential role? And I think those are the three possible entities that we have to think about the services problems. And I agree with you. I would hope by the end of this 8 quarters and this 90% that we're not paying care management fees separately anymore. And that those are blended with services dollars and that downstream somewhere, some smaller number of entities is held accountable for a single patient. And I think what health homes give us a chance to do is to study what might work clinically and organizationally in there. But I agree, we need a frame over that in terms of an accountability structure with risk and reward that's logical. And that may not be the same frame in every region.
Do you have a sense of 165 indications of interest as to
how they broke out, either by service versus manage type of system.
So the first thing we did was put them on a spreadsheet, put them on the website. So they're up there on our Health Home website. I'd say, number one, there are some very robust networks in some regions, and it actually, we were pretty heartened by what many regions did. There's some very comprehensive networks shepherded by some folks that are in this room. And then there are some, I'm a single organization, nobody would pick up the phone when I called them, so I threw my hat in it. And there's some stuff that's in between, but not much in between. So our goal is to take these single applications and marry them up to larger networks. And we also have some very large, robust networks in certain regions that have lots of crossover with their networks, and we have to have individual conversations to get there. Phasing this regionally may help us to all focus on it a little bit to do that work. We were encouraged by the applications. They were very comprehensive, well thought through. They were just letters of intent, but people sent us a lot of documents with some pretty good infrastructure built into them. So I think people were listening on those 1,000-person calls that we're having on this.
I'm also thinking to Phyllis's point. So if we knew, kind of back, this is going backwards, but if you knew who you wanted and what they could do, you might go backwards to what to ask EMS for round one.
Absolutely. And that may be very different in Bronx and Hermitage County.
Yeah.
So our basic goal is to focus this a little bit with the potential regional conversation to come up with a more limited set of robust networks that we would start with, launch it, and change it from the beginning. Just keep in a continuous change process. And again, you know, feedback like, do you want to focus, limit on diagnosis? Stuff that we can think about. We've got some shelf life on it for those spas that are going to get, you know, approved in the near future. So that's the kind of feedback we need pretty immediately.
And the shared dating, can you get into how that's going to work?
So, yeah. So this is what we're doing on payment right now. Our draft rates are up on the website. Some of your folks have commented and given us helpful feedback, so we're already changing what's out there right now. But our goal is to pay a care management fee that's adjusted by region. And right now, case mix, which is really coming from CRGs, and it's a clinical acuity factor. We are going to quickly be collecting standardized functional status information, and that will go to be added into this to adjust for it. Many folks have aptly pointed out that clinical case mix is not really a great predictor sometimes of care management needs, and things like housing and whether you speak English are sometimes more important to that, so that functional status will come into it. We've been talking to CMS, and we may be getting closer to an ability to pay our fee during outreach and engagement. That was a failure of CIDP that we did not pay during that period. There's lots of resources consumed in outreach and engagement activity, which I think was the point that was made here earlier. We'll get there. It's just a question of whether they'll actually allow us to isolate it and pay a separate fee. We have been talking about retaining a portion of the fee against achievement of core quality measures. We've not selected what those are. We have 10% out there as something for CMS to react to. Our initial plan was to push 15% of state share savings back to the provider, with conversations with many of you saying, thanks for the 15%, can we have more? We've doubled that to 30% of the state share. We're having conversations with CMS partners this week in which the topic of gain sharing on the federal side, both for the federal share of the Medicaid payment and also probably importantly on the duals, the acute care side of Medicare, and how can we begin to do some gain sharing there inside of Pioneer and other gain sharing opportunities that we went through earlier. So what we've got on the table, straight line for Medicaid for gain sharing, is a 30% equation on the state share that we'd at least like the feds to match, so that we'd end up with 30% of gross as potential savings for those entities that achieve savings against some formula that would control for the usual regression.
Will there be some sort of training for the outreach and And then in terms of the 80% of the full fee, will there be some deliverables that you would have to meet with regards to that outreach and engagement in order to collect the 80% of the fee?
So part of the great question, we don't have specific dollars tied to training. What we've been doing through our chronic illness demos, and we'll look at agreements to a much larger scale, is doing learning collaborative work where we would bring care managers to do this work together on a regular basis, and fund sharing of how outreach and engagement work is done most efficaciously. Use of peers, by the way, is what tends to work best, typically for that substance use of mental health quadrant. The deliverable for the outreach and engagement is right now we're talking to CMS about health promotion activities, mm-hmm. because that's a federally reimbursed activity. How we would measure that we're working on right now. But it would be limited right now by 3 months, that if you didn't get the person enrolled within that 3 months, you have to stop billing that care management fee if they're not signed on to care management by the end of that 3rd month. We're trying our best to stay out of lots of process here. Previously, we've said 2 contacts, you get this much money, 4 contacts, you get this much money. We really want to leave it up to the network to innovate around where do you need low touch telephonic, where do you need higher touch, more face-to-face time. And our care management team would be a blend for a provider across all of their acuity factors so that they would get one payment for all of their patients. That's a blended acuity, assuming that the people that we have in low touch, you have to do some high touch with and vice versa.
So, great. When you find the per member per month payment goes to the principal of the network?
So the per member per month payment right now, the way it's constructed outside of any sort of ACO conversation that may be occurring simultaneously, is that for fee-for-service members, it would go to this lead applicant or mothership organization that was hosting the network. On the plan side, that payment would go through the health plan down to the contracted health home network provider. And I think Pat's plan is other plans have been thinking through multiple relationships with health homes depending on their bandwidth. And I don't know, Kat, if you want to share your thinking or want me to summarize what we've been hearing. Right.
Okay, so that'd be one approach.
Pat, can you speak up?
Sure. We have about 500,000 members we estimate based on the knowledge that all the months of 70,000 health homes eligible and they've won about 13,000 members. To the extent that you have providers who are homeless or advised, we will, through some sort of patient loyalty, probably be able to figure that out. Find folks to the health home path. We do have sort of 2 other levels of model that we have been having discussions with the network. There are some, health homes that would need perhaps a little bit of support from us either on the IT or the care manager side to be able to figure out how to do it in the care management. Perhaps there is an incremental portion of the IT support. The third model.
We also have a fee for service, right? We got health homes that can go through the plans. We have health homes that can go through fee for service, right?
Correct. And so most of our patients are flowing through plans, so most of the money will flow through plans. But for fee for service patients,
we would directly contract with those approved health home motherships that are running the network.
If you went back to that matrix where you had the four quadrants, if you had a diabetic with depression,
sure.
Where would that be? Which is that in the mental health?
Yeah, the diabetic with depression, right. And that depression was showing up as a mental health substance diagnosis, or they were consuming that medicine. They're
on Zyprexa.
They would be in that center.
Is it putting them on mental health first and then doing it by medication? I mean, what's the?
Okay.
Well, it depends. If they're at home and community based, right now meeting more than 120 days.
Right, they're not in long-term care,
right.
And they would be in that third quadrant of mental health.
It's just if they were just a typical chronic diabetic with depression,
correct.
Complicated
correct.
Depression would be in the left side. Of
correct.
The
and again, we're really not in our assignment algorithm and in our thinking of this. We're looking at all 700,000 patients that are in both of those quadrants. We're not really separating them out that way.
Yeah.
So
that's why it's such a large quadrant, I think. Because a lot of people have that as
it is, and we have a lot of members of those that are in treatment.
Does that mean that basically the quadrant on the right basically are just the kind of leftover chronics?
Okay. Using the basic rules of third grade, we're going to take a break here because the crowd is restless. And my daughter's a third grade teacher. She gives me advice on how to manage stress and fatigue crowd. So let's take a 5-minute break, then we'll go to ACOs. We have a 3:30 closure. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and we have enough material to get there. I don't know if that's good or bad, but let's just stand up, take a quick stretch, and then we'll come back with the ACO. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Basically,
and they're all going to be here.
Why?
Well, they're saying
they're They are, but I think you took care of what we did.
But well, maybe we're trying to get it in. It doesn't have to be nursing home, but more like an institution.
Right.
And long-term healthcare providers. So that's like part of that work.
Right.
You'd have to have whatever the end of it's done.
Themes that we feel will play a critical role in development of ACOs. First one, of course, is data and having the proper data available. And I think one of the important pieces of the data is the establishment of the all-payer database, because when we think about ACOs, and we're thinking beyond Medicaid, that it should be encompass all payers, because that we think that the benefit would be larger, significantly larger, if we could bring all payers into the fold. So data is very critical. The payment incentives, how you structure shared savings to promote cost and coordination is also very critical, because if you don't have a shared savings structure that will incentivize everyone to participate, it doesn't go anywhere. So I think that's very critical, and we'll be looking for the input on how those should be structured. Accountability, want to make sure that whatever structure is put in place is insured value, and that math is specifically used for a cost containment measure. We need to identify the population in the system of care. You know, do you establish an ACO by region, community, or group, a population? Again, tracking and managing the care and putting the proper system in to serve that particular population, and to establish minimal ACL components to monitor the continuum of care. Now, we have basically been in a holding pattern and do a lot of research, given the fact that the federal rule was so weak, in our opinion. So what we've done is we have some white papers on various ACL approaches being used throughout the country. And on the next couple sets of slides, we've just summarized four ACO approaches that have both payment and quality measures in place that we were able to research, and we can provide backup material on these and others that we have to the work group as if you so desire. So we Brooklyn Dartmouth has an ACO that has three potential incentive pools for distribution. They have a shared savings approach. They have an incentive pool for return of capital to the principal ACO investors. They have their quality measures in place. They have a phase-in of performance measures. They have four categories of quality measures they're utilizing: cost effectiveness for the population, safety, patient engagement, overuse efficiency, and so forth. State of Maryland has five commercial plans, a self-insured plan, and Medicaid starting on April 1, 2011. So they're moving right now. Shared savings approach, they've established a baseline, and they have a 30 to 50% shared savings approach. The quality requirements are broken down into two groups: quality measures and utilization. And they've made it part of their state's primary care medical home pilot. Massachusetts, they have a global payment approach. Blue Cross Blue Shield has the ACO approach in Massachusetts. They have risk-adjusted average medical expenses in geographic areas. Performance incentives are based on aggregate performance across a set of ambulatory and hospital performance measures. They have a significant number of quality measures that they have in place. And then Vermont has a multi-payer collaborative with shared savings ACO pilot that is going to start in January of 2012. And they haven't finalized their quality measures. They're looking at NCQA. Guidelines. So there are four that we've looked at other states, Colorado.
Vermont, I think, is also experimenting with the duals. I think they have a waiver in. I think they're one of the first states to look at the dual population as well.
Right. So I think, the takeaway is once the final federal rule comes out, we'll get more into getting an ACO initiative going. But until that happens, we haven't done much work on it.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand better what we mean by other payers. I'm thinking that last 2 weeks, roughly. Out in California, you had United, huge health plan take over several thousand physicians and medical groups. In Pennsylvania, you had a hospital system approach the Blues plan and say, let's link up in a collaborative. The Blues plan came back and said, nah, you know, the more we think about it, we have to become providers. We'll buy you out. We had, what was the other one? Just last week. There was another experience last week where an insurer, I can't remember which one it was, and a big provider system created a joint venture. And so we're going to be a joint ACO, essentially. So it seems to me like the private market may actually be ahead, if not, at least concurrent with these kind of evolutions. So I'm wondering, what is it when you say the state needs to do something, or would, might want to do something? What is the something that needs to be done?
Well, I don't think we're at a limit to just Medicaid. We want to have the flexibility of whatever we finalize to allow other payers to participate.
But other than licensing, we're saying, yeah, you're an entity. But what else would you need to do? Okay. Yeah. But, you know, so the insurance department is going to oversee these. So I'm assuring you, I just want to know, is this a single payer, or is this just the licensing and, you know, applying the same kind of patient protections and stuff? Or is there something more envisioned?
We don't even know if it's a risk-based model. I mean, it's
right.
A risk-bearing model.
So that's what
we
I'm
don't,
curious.
Yeah,
what
don't.
Is the mindset that automatically assumes the government has to do something?
Well,
they're just curious.
Observing, it seems as though we have the framework for licensure, commissioner, or approval of whatever in the state,
right,
by virtue of the state law. So,
right. So I'm assuming that.
They define it differently here than it gets defined other places.
No, I'm assuming this, that other than that.
Is that
the intent? Or is there more intent? I'm just wondering, is there more intent?
I think in the end.
Yeah, well, government would naturally do
that.
Okay, so it's just the natural, normal functions of government. It's not that there's another vision for what government should do. That's all I'm asking.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we had a conversation with David Oakley with respect to Monty, just to get a sense of where we think the health commissioner's powers begin and end versus the insurance department.
Mm-hmm.
And our lawyers are still, working through that. But we think we have the ability to go quite a ways down the spectrum in terms of, sharing risk, with the understanding that there'll be reserves and those sorts of protections that, we would all expect and want to have. So we feel as though the way that the law's written, right, we were positioned, within the health department, to move forward. Where we go or the form that it takes, I mean, I think what Bill's articulating is we want to make sure that we're being consistent with the feds.
Right.
But we think we have a lot of latitude.
Well, I can see government sharing risk in a Medicaid model or a Medicare model. I didn't know if you were trying to apply that to it.
I think the private market, the Highmark example that you brought up, which is the Pittsburgh situation, is a significant. We should really take that serious. It's not about protecting patients. And it's going to only be the beginning of national companies with lots of resources that are going to come in and take over distress situations. And the short game is going to take money out of the system. The long game is not to improve the system. So we need to be creative from the state's point of view, whether it's DOH, insurance, the governor ultimately, in creating ways that obviate or block that kind of misguided adventures, because they come in with the ability to insure in the state, and they come in with resources. And their goal is to take money out of the system, not to reinvest it in the system.
I'll go a step further. Their goal is to cherry pick from the system.
Yeah, exactly.
And quite frankly, that has to be seen ahead of time by the state and precluded. You're talking about, what's brought us here today is publicly insured Medicaid population. This ACO concept is not directed towards that in the for-profit sector at all. that population is going to be left aside because that's not considered a profitable sector. And we're going to be, once again, wards of the state in trying to take care of the most difficult to manage and the most expensive populations because of the fact that ACOs are everything to everybody, and the for-profit sector will be able to walk away with significant money from the process while leaving populations uncovered. I think the state has to be much more directive in this regard and preclude that. There has to be a quid pro quo. If a for-profit carrier wants into this game, then they have to show what they're paying back into the system in terms of caring for that portion of the public.
So you have the state as a purchaser, possibly, of ACO services. That's one option. And then, to your point, you have the state as the regulator of the ACO contract.
Has to be.
Okay.
If this is an unregulated marketplace, then we will get what every unregulated marketplace is.
I guess I'm asking also, if a not-for-profit local insurer links up with a medical group or a hospital, and says, we want to be the ACO, let's say it's Rochester, you have Excel, it's a big not-for-profit insurer, links up with Via Health or Strong, or the Rochester APA that exists out there through clinical integration today. It could be any of them. And say, okay, we want to go directly to Xerox, Bausch & Lomb, and who's left out there, and say, here's an ACO. Licensed by the state or certified or whatever it is the state does. I don't see the state needing to somehow do anything to intrude itself on the negotiations that go around.
No, they need to regulate that transaction so that the transaction, whether they're nonprofit or not, keeps the money in the system. It keeps the money in the care.
Right, but and also, I mean, maybe it doesn't matter, but the patients in that ACO will have no protections under the state managed care bill of rights. They won't have any insurance protections. They will have nothing. They won't have appeal rights. They'll be in real deep trouble unless the Department of Health, unless I misunderstand how it will work, I don't.
I guess I've been working on the assumption that the basic rules of
I don't see why we would think that based on at least the version of the law I saw.
No, I mean, they're saying other than the normal kind of state oversight, is there anything more than that?
That's what we objected to last spring.
So if one appears,
we'll
start categorizing it right away. Is that fair?
15 minutes for dish, really?
Other questions?
The dish program, we are changing care. And I agree, 15 minutes, no way.
15 minutes, time to zero.
We'll go through this real quickly. We can take, you know, at the next meeting, we can do a more in-depth presentation on care if it's needed. 4 years ago, we had a regular work group on aging care that met 3 or 4 times and prepared a report and recommendations. Unfortunately, not all the recommendations went forward because there are, you have to be very careful. There's unintended consequences on what you may do, and you have to be very, very sensitive to the fiscal reallocation of funds to the institution when you think you're doing the right thing. There's a lot to this. There's a lot of money involved. That's the federal DSH law for 2010-11 was $11 million. New York share was 1.6 federal dollars, or 14, almost a little over 14% of the total federal dollars put out there. So you double that, of course. So we have a $3.2 billion DSH program here in New York State. So when they start talking about reductions at the federal level, and we're looking at significant reductions state level also. So the next slide is, there's really five streams. This money is broken down into five streams. There's the voluntary hospitals get in, and the public hospitals get the regular, what I'll call the normal aging care pool distribution. That it's $795 million on this chart, but it's really about $1.1 million before the reallocation of the voluntary upper payment limit
payment. So the net is the $795. Then there is some industry care adjustment that goes to public hospitals only, and that's another $412 million. There's the public hospital dish IGT payments that go to the public hospitals, including the state-operated hospitals. Then we, by federal law, we have an allocation that goes to the mental health psychiatric hospitals. It used to be 20% of the dish allotment, and it was frozen back a few years back. So it's frozen at $605 million. And then there's an Old Mage Oasis voluntary hospital dish allotment of $60 million. So that's the breakdown of the $3.2 billion for New York State the dish program. When you talk about complicated, I mean, we start looking at all of the small and various pools that make up the larger pool in the distribution model. Some of these have been carried over from past years, et cetera. So we start really looking at the methodology and how the monies are allocated and everything. It's very, very complicated. That's why I would think that a more in-depth session and presentation on how these pools work and the interaction of those would be more appropriate and everything. But we just wanted to depict on how complicated it is to calculate the annual pool distribution for DISH.
I think the other inclusive hilarious. Sorry.
Yeah, I think the reason why we put the other there, I know it's an
Sorry.
Important point, is what we're trying to capture is we all know that the federal government, right, when they changed the allocations, they want it to be allocated on Medicaid or uninsured, right? The other, right, is basically the portion of the pools that are currently being allocated based on bad debt and charity care. So that's why we put that there.
And we just wanted to put down a source of fund issue for the almost $5.4 billion that are collected in the HIPAA pool, in which the Indigent Care funding comes out of. The biggest piece of it is through the HIPAA surcharges. That's 47% of the $5.4. It's supposed to be $1 billion. Sorry. Oh, that's right. And then the cigarette tax revenue is 24%.
You know that phone number?
Then the next largest component of the HICRA sources of funds is covered lives assessment of 19%. So big responsibilities, a lot of money collected through the HICRA resources and
the only point I would make here is that when Dan mentioned earlier about some of the actions that the federal government was taking to reduce the tax cap, right? It'll be these dollars here. Right?
So which bit of these? All of it, or
the surcharge, right? The surcharge and the 1% hospital assessment would fall into those buckets.
Fall into that bucket. We're just below the 6%.
Covered lives assessment.
No. And again, these, see, you got this pool, right? These dollars basically go to fund the, we call the Christmas tree of HICRA programs. So these dollars are basically funding health care, right, in New York State. That's the way our system works. We have a series of HICRA pools. This is a resource into the pool. We fund the DISH program out of it. We fund CHIP out of it. We fund portions of Family Health Plus, right, all get funded with these dollars on the expenditure side within the financial plan. So when they're cutting the surcharges, they're in essence cutting our pool, which funds health care in New York State.
Are all 5 million match dollars? Is this 100% match?
No. Like, for example, the cigarette tax.
No.
Right, is not. It's okay. Just a tax, right? The covered lives is an assessment on, you know, covered lives. It's the Medicaid's portion of the surcharge
right, which is probably 25% of that number, right, is matched. The federal government, right, and the state government pays its share of the surcharges. So this is better looked at as just like a revenue pie.
But if you look at the page before, you've got the $1.1 billion is the pool. Is this half the pool? That's the 50% of it. This goes to fund the indigent care pool?
Yes, it does.
So this is 5375. You double it, basically, to get the federal match?
No, it's better to look at, this would be kind of the revenue source, and then we have a whole, we call it Christmas tree. It's a whole list of programs, right, that get funded with these dollars.
Only a portion of this goes to
care for? Yeah, just a portion of it.
Right.
And we can, if you want, we can show you how we spend the $5.3 billion. But it's safe to say that that full $5.3 billion gets spent on health care in New York. Right? So, for example, Child Health Plus, right? The state share, 35%. Right? What's that?
Roswell gets
Yeah,
there's a whole,
right.
Yeah.
Right? Family Health Plus, I think the EPIC program.
There's a great, and that actually makes a great chart.
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess of that, the question is of the 1.182 indigent care pool funds,
right,
how much is coming out of here?
The non-federal share of that gets funded out of here.
Okay, so is there a non-federal share?
We match it again. It gets created.
Okay.
But we take these dollars, right?
You don't want to get it. John Holder.
Where does the Diagnostic and Treatment Center on Indigent Care fund?
That's another excellent example of an expenditure that we're not showing here, but the dollars out of the revenues out of this pool go over and fund that $55 million from the DNTC Indigent Care, which we're going to match again in the future here. Got approval from the Fed to do that.
Maybe for the for the next meeting, maybe it would be helpful to have the
we'll put both pies side by side.
Yeah.
So if this is going to be reduced, will the match that New York makes will also be reduced, right? And
I have problems, maybe even more so than Mr. Sisto, about this cut that the federal government is imposing on the state. Is that, you know, they're cutting the taxes that go to fund health care. That only puts more pressure on the state. So
it's not equal.
No. I have just a hard time, you know, and I'm not sure what necessarily they're getting out of it, other than the fact that they want us to cut the Medicaid program. But right now it's sitting in our lap.
No, it goes towards deficit. It's in the president's
bank. It gets accounted.
That's how he gets out.
Yeah, but these are our dollars, though.
Yeah, but the surcharge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how it becomes.
But everybody's claiming you can't claim the federal money.
Right.
Yeah, that's what he's blocking you. He's blocking you from expanding whatever.
Right, but in not every case do we claim the federal money. A hospital assessment, for example, that's just a straight assessment.
Right. You have collateral damage.
Exactly.
So it's the 25% of the surcharge
that's right.
By the cut.
That's right.
Surcharge.
That's right. I mean, they're
perfectly clear.
Yeah, no, it could, yeah, depending on how we decide. Right.
So I guess I'm missing the 2.5 and the 300 are the 2.8 billion, right?
It's not going to be better.
Right.
You're saying the 25% of 2.8 billion is 700 billion, I guess, multiplying.
Right.
Is that what you're at risk, you're saying, or we're at risk?
I think what we have to decide with this tax cap coming down is how do we want to effectuate the reduction in the tax.
Is that the number,
700 million? Again, I'm just ballpark is my estimate. But, I mean, that surcharge is applied on both Medicaid, right, and private insurers, right? Our surcharge rate is 7%. The privates are 9%, right? So, you know, so what do? We're going to bring the surcharge rate down, right? That will have a direct effect on the state's financial plan.
Right.
Right. How we deal with that, right, is something that I think the state's really got to figure out, because right now we know our pools are short of resources that we have over here to pay for health care.
Well, I guess probably what you should do is try to take the savings from the Medicaid program
to
get as low as we can.
I have
to think about it more.
Medicaid, anything that's
matched. Nobody's already matched, though.
Yeah, this is something actually, because now that we know that this is on the table, we've been having some conversations with, you know, Elizabeth, who has
have other conversations with, you know, the affected folks in terms of how or what are we going to do? How are we going to effectuate this? And I don't have the answer to that. I just know right now it's becoming more of a state problem, right? And I don't know how the Fed even values the savings associated with it because, again, the example here is we could just reduce the hospital assessment. Hospitals would be happy with that, I'm sure, right? Because
because we know that.
Well, because but again, the problem is really the state's problem because when we reduce the assessment, the pools are short, and we have to decide how to make it up.
Right.
That's
why
we're going to approach that. That's right.
Point
that
one out.
Yeah.
Lose the match and your pools are short.
Right.
Right.
A double win.
Right. Okay. And the hospital assessment, there is no match, right, because it's just a straight tax. It's not reimbursable. Right? So you got all these different dynamics right here on this. Right, we need to sort out what's the best way to do damage control on the state's financial plan as well as on the healthcare community, and we're working on that.
And then,
so
I'm not even
getting
to the other point, which is how, you know, this beautiful chart is actually right. I mean, like, there's problems with that piece too.
Right. Right.
I hope we'll talk more about.
No, understood. I mean, I think we're just trying to give you the lay of the land. We can get into the details, and we're not trying to. I know we're running out of time, and we want to give every section its due, including the safety net. But again, so we'll come back. We'll show you the other side of the pie, which is the expenditure side. We'll give some more thought in terms of how we think we might be able to deal with the tax cap cut. I think our first thing is to figure out when does the real cut start, because it's. We're not at 6% statewide today. So the first part of that cut may have no effect on us at all, and it can generate no benefit to the feds because we're below the cap, and they would just be cutting, in essence, air. Yeah, but we just our first step is to find out kind of what is our effective tax rate now and how does that compare to the initial reduction from 6% down to wherever they're going in the first. So we have some work to do in terms of valuing the impact.
But if I could, you know, but I think this discussion is really, really creates the need. I mean, really focuses on the need for creativity back to the providers of care. Now, if I'm not mistaken, $127 million that pays for the excess layer of medical malpractice coverage is also paid for under the HIPAA.
That's another example. Yeah.
Okay. And Art, you're going to love what I say next. But for example. We could really take the next steps for medical liability reform that is tied to performance measurements. Perhaps then the doctors can give, you know, you give back a portion of all of the $127 million. And again, something that the medical society talked about. And again, it's not to get into the debate, but we've got to be creative and we've got to be smart about doing this. But at some measure where you can again Steve, as you said, keep the money in the system. You can then use that $127 million or a portion thereof for other purposes within the pool, especially when you see the tax rate decline in the future.
So we've been spending a lot of time at Community Service Society analyzing the $1.182 billion and trying to understand it. I mean, we've also been looking at the actual financial assistance policies that hospitals use, and I'll send around just a little PowerPoint that we've been working on, trying to think about our thinking. But I just to that point, I think if we could actually tie this $1.182 billion to the actual financial assistance law, because right now this money isn't allocated based on people that have been certified eligible, uninsured or underinsured, whatever, who've been certified eligible for financial assistance under our current state law. And so I think that's another potential area for savings, that if we kind of tie sort of the front-end system when people go and actually say, I'm uninsured, I can't get care, to the back-end of, you know, hospitals getting uncompensated care funding, I think that would go a long way to sort of make building confidence that these monies are being spent wisely. So I'll send around a PowerPoint that we've been working on that kind of makes that case. And then eventually we'll put out a report in another month or two, but it won't be in time for the MRT process probably.
Part of the struggle, you know, that we're talking about in the past is
differentiating between inability to pay and unwillingness to pay. Hmm. At the front, especially.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get to it, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, just to go to that point, I mean, a significant portion of this funding is now currently funding bad debt as opposed to the charity care piece. And I think we have to think about that from a public good perspective. And you know, and I think certainly as we go forward under the ACA implementation, we're not allowed to spend this DSH funding on so much of it on bad debt. So it's, you know, an inevitable, I mean, there's a reckoning coming in 2014, you know, assuming it all stays in place, there's a reckoning coming in 2014 regardless. So we need, I think we should, it would behoove us to be thinking about it in this committee more seriously.
Which leads to this next slide, it's a common theme that, was mentioned at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
We have to be cognizant of what's going to happen on the federal level. In regards to DSH, and, as John mentioned, we've been trying to pull out of CMS for a long time now what their guidance is going to be and what their criteria are going to be for establishing DSH caps going forward. But what we do know is that federal DSH money, the allotment is going to be reduced, and the reduction methodology is going to be applied to the state by three criteria. General criteria, we don't know the details behind it. Three general criteria: numbers of uninsured, how the state uses this to subsidize hospitals to find Medicaid and uncompensated care volumes, excluding bad debt, and a portion of the state's additional allotment used to expand eligibility through a section 1115 waiver. So, with a footnote here is that low DSH states will experience a smaller percentage reduction than high DSH states. Of course, New York is considered a high DSH state.
The low DSH states going to have a great amount of expansion of insurance on the ACA by definition.
Right.
So it's again, a net transfer of money, and the only way to ever get out of methodology that would be fair would be to fix it at the hospital level or the FARO level. It has to be regional. It has to be in that area. I mean, it's wonderful that 40 million people may get health insurance country, but there's not an upside in a lot of the places that we provide care. So if the money goes away, it goes to Iowa. That's where it goes. In the form of insurance.
Understood. To complicate matters and make matters worse, there are also changes going on the federal Medicare DSH allocation payment methodology. So Amy prepared this slide for us. That just gives some general points, makes some general points about how the Medicare DSH payments are going to be reduced. So you can just look those over. You can discuss them further. The aggregate DSH reduction is going to affect for federal fiscal year 13-14, and the first year is going to be a $500 million reduction. Nationwide, the estimated New York State share, and these are really gross calculations, is going to be $71 million. So our statewide allocation, we think, will be down about $70 million. It increases as it goes out. It goes up to $600 million for the 14-15, 15-16. And then, of course, as health insurance kicks in, then there's more significant reductions for the DSH allocation.
Do you
know
what the DSH number is that
they're
coming from? That 500
in
the first year? Is that from?
Yes, from 11 billion.
In terms of trying to approach what Steve is saying, I think we should be talking about
that we may not be getting the benefit, and maybe that this shouldn't be reduced to New York State.
We may fight forever in this room about
who proposes,
and that's reasonable, but we should be united externally, because this is egregious. This is a net transfer of money from blue states to red states. That's what it is. And that's how it passed.
So I guess my question is,
ACA was passed on DSH cuts that are based on national reductions in uninsured. It has no sensitivity. It doesn't have the appropriate sensitivity to
by a blue state president.
By a blue state president.
But I don't mean that we can't go there.
No, we need to advocate it in a unified way. We need to understand that and work together on that.
But on both fronts, so that we're asking to get that advocacy to think about how we respond.
Yeah, well, it would be easier to argue for if it was more accountable.
Okay, Phil, thanks for bringing us to this point of consensus.
equitable plus accountable.
Just very clear that it takes a while to get to this unanimity of thought. But that's where we ended. That's where we're ending today. We're not about to move on in the last 10 minutes to take on safety and hospital nursing home and clinic.
Can we have the materials for the next meeting, even the morning of the day before?
Yeah,
that's
right.
I mean, it would be so helpful.
Right, you're welcome.
Comments on today's meeting, other thoughts?
Yes.
Any observations? Want to leave time? Yes.
A point that I wondered about, even in advance of the meeting, I think we talked about, it's very, very interesting. In many ways. And I think we, as the discussion went along, people brought up different issues. We have, I believe, totally two meetings. I want to check that. Are there two more meetings, or is there only
one? There are two more scheduled meetings for this group.
And I was feeling much more settled and comfortable. I kind of knew what was expected out of them in the next two meetings. Taking notes, I could observe that there seems to be consensus on some issues or other issues raised. I mean, those don't quite rise to the level of recommendation, but I have the feeling that we need to come out with some recommendations, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Other thought, I mean, I think that's a valid point. We entered this meeting fairly open-ended fashion. I think it was, in my opinion, it was very educational, very clear. There's some very bright people involved around the table and in the department over very complex issues. But we are leaving here today not quite having completed our first homework assignment. And with, as you point out, two meetings to come to some consensus in terms of recommendations. How we will do that, we should give a lot of thought to between now and the next meeting about what I can say. I don't know. Do you have other thoughts?
No,
I think that's about where we are. That's where we are in life.
I think from, because we get together every couple of weeks and find out how the other groups are, and I think we're basically having the same experience that, you know, that the other groups have had, which is there's a lot of information, right? We need to develop some recommendations, right? We need some time to think through, you know, where is it that we really want to go. Some of the strategies they've used is, you know, if you don't want to limit yourself just to two meetings and you want to have a conference call to go over a particular issue, certainly that's, you know, allowable if you know, people think that there's need to get the group together more to flush out an issue. If there are certain things people would like us to do additional research on.
It just strikes me that, again, as extraordinarily informative as the meeting is today, this is the type of a meeting which a conference call lends itself to, because you're imparting information. Many people in the room already knew some of that information, pieces of it, not all of it, all put together in the way that you did. I think where face-to-face is critical is when recommendations start to be discussed. And at the pace that we're going, that'll be sometime next January. I'm concerned that spending the energy to get everybody in the room together, which is considerable, to inform ourselves of the current status quo, which is what we did today, may not be our best use of resources. I'm just proposing that. And that the time and energy to get everybody together needs to be, that's when the arguments start. That's when people start throwing things across the room at each other. But that's when it's productive.
One advantage of today is that we now know with whom we'll be arguing.
Just some logistics. One, the third meeting is right here, right? We had a meeting scheduled for October 7th, and do I understand that meeting is up in the air because of the winter holiday?
Yes, I think we...
Seventh was it? It was looking to be
because of the holidays. Yeah, and I think we still have not yet landed.
Right, but so just to clarify that I know the same thing.
Take that off our schedule.
And
I don't think it's off yet.
And just the second issue, and this is not to be taken as a complaint in any way. I just want to clear. I saw this deck when I walked in today for the first time. Is that what we all did, or I didn't miss something? Did I?
No.
Okay, it's not a complaint. I mean, it really is. I understand.
No, I was the one that was officially complaining about that.
And you were not selected out.
You it's just an issue of whether or not we missed something. So then my comment is this. I'm kind of feeling how I could look through this and get the five subject areas in which I could sort of talk to you about what you ought to do next year. What I'm not getting is that I'd really tell anybody I had walked away with a long-term discussion about how to take on some of the big stuff. So, I mean, that's just where the charge is and how long the scope is, and I really understand all the realities of needing to get to something so the governor can look at what next year looks like, and that I get. And then the feds are going to play, but I mean, the feds are making budget moves. The feds are making reform moves. I will say I don't think that we've captured very well in this conversation what the private insurance companies are doing. And I think that's really critical. We've talked about it in different ways. So that's just the take about how I'm feeling coming out of what I think has been a good discussion, a lot of material, a refresher on a number of items. But I'm not feeling how to get to a big picture. I'm pointing out the fact that the last time I tried this was Sunderland Lombardi. It took us 3 years to get to this point in the conversation. So it's a long time ago. Things move much more slowly.
Other comments? Sounds like we need a little more framework for the next meeting, both in terms of information out beforehand and perhaps some talking points from which we could launch a little more directly, whether it be, Steve said, into the air or off a cliff, we will determine at that time. But that we can, at a minimum, I think, put that together for the next meeting.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, too, that this is an outgrowth, whether we like it or not, of last year's discussion. Mm-hmm. And last year's discussion mostly was, how do we save a certain number of dollars? We decided we're going to save it from reform initiatives. Well, the department didn't wait till we had a meeting to discuss the reform initiatives. Right, so we got the medical homes and the health homes and all of them. So now it is, in a way, given these initiatives and a few others that haven't been yet defined, how do you incent them? You know, how do you support them? How do you encourage them? We can have a fight about how to redistribute money anytime, and we do all the time. But if you're talking about a 3 to 5 year horizon of reform, I'm not uncomfortable that this was basically a grounding in what, in fact, has happened. And now it's how do you switch it up a gear? How do you engage and what are you looking to protect and drive? But at the end of the day, this is still about money. More than it's still about money. Now we're going to save it.
I'd say it goes back to your comment that you said that you know that what A looks like and what B looks like, and the idea is how we get there. I think this was a very good, at least for me, it was a very good overview, a very quick in some areas where we were and where we are and kind of where we need to be. And I go back to the graph that says that we're at $30 million and we need to get to $18 million. And I think that part of the work here is, you know, what are the recommendations to help us transition? What is the funding opportunities that the state can provide in terms of incentives or transition dollars to get us there? and then really try to identify the opportunities with some of these new models that are going to help us not only reduce the cost, but be able to sustain some of that going forward, which I think that's a real very, very big lift.
The only other thing I would point out is that we aren't really talking about reimbursement methodologies in this work group, and we should probably just say somehow in our charge that that's not part of our job if it's not right, because it does seem like it's sort of obvious that someone, maybe we should say that, because none of our, right? I mean, we're doing a little bit around quality and incentive-y kind of stuff, but we're in medical homes here, but we're not talking about.
Well, we did APR DRGs, and I had my fill, so I wasn't really necessarily.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just, I mean, but I feel that we should say that we're not.
Well, I think that's a good point.
I mean, yeah. Like, I mean, when you think of the payment committee, you would think that that's what we're
right.
really looking at, and we're really not, right? I
well,
mean,
I
mean, I'm missing something.
You're right. I don't think there's any aspect of.
I mean, sort of to Pat's point of her 3% cut or whatever that the plan is.
I don't think there's any aspect of hospital or, for the most part, continuing care reimbursement that we have not altered in the last 2.5 years. So, you know, we've had done all these changes in reimbursement methodologies. We've gone to pricing models. We've moved money all over the place. Most providers have no clue why they got money or lost money. They hadn't changed any incentives because they didn't understand from the get-go why we were doing it. But now we're here. So I don't think it was ever the intent to go back and redo methodology so much as to incent the reform structures we've agreed
right.
or envisioned.
So,
positive or negative.
So I found this incredibly useful, and I don't want the department or anybody else to say otherwise as we talk
right.
about what we need to do. What would, and in a way, I see us in service to the department, which has so much more information on so many more fronts. Than I do to put together a big picture. What would be really useful, and at the risk of repetition, would be to have someone, and I go and think of this department, say, look, why don't you focus on these three issues, A, B, and C, because these are going to be the really big ones for the next year or the next 5 years. Or alternately, focus on these two opportunities and this threat, because that's where we think the bang is. Then I would have a framework in which to, you know how to focus my energy and my attention. I can't figure that out myself because there's too much incoming right now. So I just want to know how we can be most effective.
Yeah,
in
those are good constructive suggestions coming forward.
Thanks, guys.
So we'll work with DOH and
Thank you.
Try and be a little more.
So our concluding thoughts for today is here's where we are. We know that much, and from there we will go forward at our next meeting, and we know we have a good group to do it. So thank you all, and we'll see you at the next meeting.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, very nice. Thank you. Yeah,
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted.
Rectal cancer screening test, mammograms, and prostate cancer test. Learn more about your Medicare rights and protections. Stay on the line. You may also call 1-800-MEDICARE or visit the Medicare website at www.medicare.gov. Information about Medicare benefits, billing, and how to compare the quality of care provided by nursing homes, home health agencies, and hospitals.
We appreciate your waiting. We'll be right back on the line.
learn more about iPro programs and services, visit our website at www.ipro.org. Thank you for calling iPro. A leading healthcare consulting organization, iPro provides a full spectrum of healthcare assessment and improvement services with the goal of improving healthcare for the common good.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.